Ladies and gentlemen, if you could all take your seats, it's time to begin the afternoon panel. My name is Rita Hauser, and I am very pleased to moderate this panel, and I also want to indicate my personal pleasure at being able to assist in this program, because I think the U.S. Institute of Peace is just doing a splendid job in the general and in the particular in putting this conference together in a most timely and effective way to elucidate the issues we're all debating. I would like to say that I think all of us and people all over the world who must call themselves lovers at some time surely must count how many times they've played our song, how many times we've been in the restaurant, how many times we went to Paris together. Well, I think, speaking for myself, the members of the panel, and many in the audience, alas, we could count how many times we have been in seminars, programs, debates, and policies dealing with prospects for peace in the Middle East. And we are here again on one more occasion with that same elusive topic, and we are here once again trying to see whether or not, in all of the violence that now permeates the Israel-Palestine conflict, as well as the situation in the general area, there are some prospects indeed, some shreds or hopes for a peaceful process going forward. I think all of you know the members of the panel. You've all heard them and seen them and read their materials. Their biographies are in the materials that are passed out as part of your program. What we intend to do is to give each speaker 10 minutes, and I'll be rigorous about that because I know there's going to be an enormous amount of interest in the question session on the whole range of Israel, Palestine, Iraq, Iran, etc. So I'm going to turn the podium over first to Martin Indyk and follow down sequentially as you see them on the platform. Martin?
Thank you very much, Rita. It's a pleasure to be here today. I thank the U.S. Institute of Peace for inviting me for putting this topic on the agenda, even though it does have a sense of deja vu about it, as Rita says. This is probably the most uncomfortable podium I've ever been on because there are these lights that are shining in our eyes up here. We cannot see you, except I managed to see Ambassador Lewis and Ambassador Kempelman over there. So I wanted to acknowledge at least that I could see you. if we seem a little distant from you, it's because we can't really relate to you in any direct way. Rita said I had 10 minutes, and so I'm going to go quickly over the four reasons that I believe we should be optimistic about the chances for seeing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict move out of this horrendous phase of violence and terrorism that has racked both sides for the last 2 years with enormous casualties on both sides, human terms, and of course in political terms, the biggest casualty of all is the peace process itself. It's one thing to face terrorism on the way to an agreement. It's another thing to face the breakdown of the agreement and violence and terrorism that produced it, and try from that to rebuild to a new process. I think it's far more difficult. So much has been destroyed of the very essence of trust and coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians, a trust and coexistence that was attempted to be built up over 8 years painstakingly, and it's all been destroyed. So we face a situation where it's hard to be optimistic. Nevertheless, I wanted to run through why I think there are actually grounds for optimism. The first is on the Palestinian side. There is now a very real sense of exhaustion on the Palestinian side, and out of that exhaustion comes a willingness on the part of more and more people in the nationalist camp, arguing that this intifada has been a disaster for the Palestinians and it's time to chart a new political course. The impact on Palestinian support around the world, particularly in the United States, of the resort to violence and terrorism, the lack of support from the Arab world over the last 2 years, the effective destruction of the Palestinian Authority, its basic collapse, and with it the collapse of the Palestinian economy, all of these things, I should add, and the collapse of the peace camp in Israel across the board, and unwillingness of any political leader from left to right in Israel to even countenance doing a deal with Yasser Arafat, let alone the kind of deal that Ehud Barak was prepared to offer him back at the end of 2000. That has all, I think, finally hit home to Palestinians to the point where you have some very interesting indicators of a change. The one that I would just point to, since my time is limited, that is most stark, is the way in which the new Minister of Interior is going around publicly speaking to his own people about the need to stop the violence and terrorism, and the way in which the Islamist extremist organizations, Hamas, the Islamic Jihad and so on, are now in the position where they at least have to engage in a discussion with the nationalist camp about calling it off, even though they oppose doing so. And you see a couple of days ago published in the Arab press a letter basically indicting Yasser Arafat for his failures in precisely the terms that I'm talking about here, by Nabil Amar, a former minister of the Palestinian Authority. That kind of view is now becoming quite prevalent on the Palestinian side, a recognition that what they had been offered by President Clinton and Prime Minister Barak was something worth accepting, therefore a beginning of a removal of the kind of denial that we've seen over the last 2 years, and much more of a coming to terms with what has happened, which I think is the beginning of a process of trying to dig out. And the sign of that in terms of on the political level is what Prime Minister Sharon let slip, purposely of course, in an interview a couple of days ago, in which he said that he'd been contacted by a senior Palestinian leader who wanted to begin negotiations. I'll come back to Sharon and the Israelis in a moment, but let me move to the second reason for optimism, which is on the Arab front. There, what we've seen in the Saudi initiative is a very different posture from the Arab states than we've seen in the last few years. And this came, remember, in the midst of the most horrendous days of the Intifada, when the Israeli army was responding to Palestinian violence and terrorism with a very strong military offensive, and yet the Saudis came up with this initiative which was endorsed by the Arab League. And that endorsement was very interesting because it stands in stark contrast with the position that much of the Arab world has adopted for a long time. If you remember back to 1968, the Khartoum summit after the Six-Day War, in which the Arab League issued the famous three no's of Khartoum: no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with Israel. The Arab League summit in Beirut last year, by contrast, came up with, or was it this year? It was this year, came up with resolution that offered Israel an end to the conflict, peace treaties, and normal relations with the Jewish state. Of course, there were some other things that were problematic, but that essence of that offer was, I think, very important and indicates a willingness on the part of the Arab world to end this conflict and to find a way to make peace with Israel. And the fact that the Saudis led this initiative, whereas previously they'd always been the caboose on the peace train, they're now prepared to be the engine, is, I think, an important indicator of a shift, not just in Saudi attitudes, but the way in which that opens up the space, puts some competition into their relationship with Egypt and forces the Egyptians to be more active in trying to promote peace, is all part of that second reason for optimism. Thirdly, the Israelis. The Israelis, like the Palestinians, are also exhausted. And there is no doubt that the Israeli polity has shifted quite dramatically to the right as a result of the tremendous disappointment that the Israeli public has felt in what happened. Their narrative, although I think the Palestinians would disagree with it, but their narrative is one in which Israel made the Palestinians a very generous offer. They rejected it and resorted to violence. And the kind of violence, the terrorist attacks in Israel proper, in coastal cities like Tel Aviv and Netanya, Rishon LeZion, etc., I think drove home to all Israelis a sense that the Palestinians don't want peace. And there's no reliable partner on the Palestinian side to deal with. But now, I think as a result of exhaustion and as a result of this conflict of the last 2 years, alongside that attitude is another attitude which is very clear in the polls. It is an attitude which recognizes that Israel needs peace for its survival and that is willing, in the words of Prime Minister Sharon, to make painful compromises to achieve that, including, if you look at the polls, significant solid majorities for evacuating settlements, for withdrawing from most of the West Bank, even for as controversial a proposition as a solution which would give the Arab suburbs of East Jerusalem back to Palestinian sovereignty. I shouldn't say back to, but over to the Palestinian sovereignty. Ariel Sharon himself, again in these interviews that he's given in the last couple of days, in effect very quietly declared victory, in which he said the Palestinians are coming to realize that they cannot achieve anything through violence and terrorism. I call it a declaration of victory because it indicates that he is beginning to lay the groundwork for an engagement on the political level. And in order to do that, he has to cover himself by explaining that, in fact, Israel has won the battle of the Intifada, and even though there may be continued terrorist attacks, essentially the point has been driven home to the Palestinians. They understand it now, that they can't get anything through violence, so it's okay to begin a political negotiation. And then, as I say, he put out that he'd been contacted by a senior Palestinian and was going to begin talks with him. And that's, I think, a reflection of this other mood in the Israeli street, of a desire for some political track, some political horizon. And as he heads into an election next year, perhaps an early election, he wants to be able to say, this is Sharon, I not only stop the violence and terror, but I have a way to achieve a peace, at least an interim agreement with the Palestinians. I only have a short time, and that is probably good because my fourth reason for optimism is a little shakier than the other three. It relates to the United States. We had in the Bush administration a shift from a determined disengagement from the conflict at the beginning of the administration. Slowly, over time, painfully, to the point on June 4th where the president declared a bold vision of a democratic Palestinian state living in peace alongside Israel. And that held out the hope that the United States was going to get directly involved in fulfilling this vision, something that had been lacking, something that I think could have made a significant difference in attenuating the violence and terrorism if we'd gotten more engaged, particularly on the security level. But it held out the hope that we would now get engaged and work with these other trends to get the process back on track. Well, it turns out that that speech was apparently a hit-and-run speech. That is, hit Yasser Arafat and run on to Baghdad. But I think that what we'll see is that in the next few months, as we ramp up to the war on Baghdad, especially if these other factors, these other vectors, I should say, that I've identified, basically because the American people want to see a broader coalition, as it tries to build a broader coalition, and as it seeks to bring the Arabs on board as well, it will, I think, see the need as well to be more actively engaged. The best thing they could do would be to take advantage of this opportunity by appointing a high-level presidential envoy, preferably George Mitchell. It gives them the opportunity to tell our Arab allies, whom we will need for this war in Iraq, that we're doing something, and it's precisely the kind of thing that George Mitchell would be perfect at, which is small steps, working with the parties, to rebuild the confidence, to take advantage of the exhaustion and the desire for a political solution, to get us back on track towards a solution for the Israeli-Palestinian problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Great honor to speak under the auspices of the U.S. Institute of Peace again, an institute I've been associated with and proudly so. I'm afraid that my presentation is a lot less optimistic than Martin's. Let me begin with that. I agree with a lot of the issues that Martin summarized pertaining to the opportunities that could in fact be exploited. But let me explain to you why I am less optimistic. I think it is true when Martin cited a very important statement by the Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, saying now he sees an opportunity for moving forward because, quote, he now thinks that he has essentially sent the message, the Palestinians have received the message that violence doesn't pay, and now they're ready to talk along his terms. I think there is something that doesn't represent reality in that statement that we find, at least in the way we're pulling people in the Palestinian areas and in Israel, and also in terms of the studies we've done over the past 20 years as to how Israelis and Palestinians behave in relation to each other. But let me begin with just a reminder. Today, a 1,300-pound truck bomb was discovered before it exploded in northern Israel. Shimon Peres, the foreign minister of Israel, was quoted as, has this bomb exploded, quote, it would have changed politics as we have known it. So all I am saying is just imagine these kind of events that are almost unavoidable about changing the nature of politics. So we have to keep that in the background as to what happens in the process. We have had a period of a few weeks in which there's been less violence than before. But to build expectations about, on the basis of that is really unrealistic. When we have done a study for a period of 20 years in terms of how the parties act and react to each other over a period of 20 years on a daily basis, a study that I've done with three other colleagues, it became clear that over a 20-year period, what takes place is that both sides learn to react in kind, that reciprocity becomes normalized, that the tit-for-tat becomes the operating norm more and more over time. But what was also obvious over that entire period between 79 and 99 was that the parties do not learn from that they should cooperate, even though it should be quite evident that they're worse off by not cooperating. We see that, for example, in the data that Martin correctly cited. If Sharon is right, then the Palestinians and the Israelis should have learned. The Israeli police recently released the statistics about the bombings of this year. Over 460 bombings took place in the first part of this year, in comparison to only a little over 100 last year, and in comparison to only 11 bombings in the year 1999, the full year before the collapse of the Camp David negotiations. It's quite astonishing. Certainly, Israel has not attained security. Sharon was elected to bring about security, and every single month, things have gotten worse, not better, for the Israelis. And for the Palestinians, it's quite evident, as Martin correctly identified. It's horrific on the ground. Not only is peace not imminent for them, but they live under miserable conditions. And even if you don't hear about bombings and death, you have to imagine to yourself living under 24-hour curfew, as many of them continue to live under. No mobility, no movement. It has done to the psychology of the children, to the psychology of a generation, to the poverty that is pervasive right now. It's horrific conditions. And you would think that clearly they should have learned that from that they should cooperate. Well, the history of it shows that they don't. And in fact, the most recent survey, which was commissioned by the Search for Common Ground and conducted by the University of Maryland, actually indicates that while a majority of Palestinians and Israelis support the use of nonviolence as a method of resistance, they want to see more nonviolent methods of resistance, a majority of the people still believe that they shouldn't give up the violent method and, quote, that the violent method actually works. They believe it actually works, even though it should be obvious that it doesn't if you look at it. And so the question is why. Let me give you three different explanations as why they don't learn and why, frankly, they're not likely to learn. It's a self-delusion to think that somehow suddenly they're going to wake up one day and say, we're better off cooperating, therefore let's go back to the table. It just doesn't happen that way. That's not the way history takes place. First, there's domestic politics. The reason why Paris made the statement it would have changed politics if this bomb had gone off, you can imagine what the public would have demanded in Israel. And even if the Israeli measures themselves of reacting, bombing Gaza or someplace else, would not have solved the problem, in any case, the public demands answers. And the domestic political arena pushes leaders to do things that are strategically self-defeating. And that isn't something that is always there, and it almost always wins out. The public doesn't accept that governments have no options, that they can't do something, that they can sit on the sideline. The Palestinians cannot accept that of their leaders, and that's why they end up supporting others, and the Israelis cannot support that of the leaders. And when you're hopping from one funeral to another, when you have the hardship that both sides face every single day, it is difficult to get from out of that. That is a trap that they find themselves in. The second reason is actually rather interesting because it's strategic in nature, and you hear it in almost every conflict, but especially among Palestinians and Israelis. The Palestinians and Israelis will tell you things like, we know this is not going to work. The Israeli defense minister, when he sometimes explains action, says, I know this is not going to work, but I have to do it anyway. The reason they give is that if they don't react in kind, the other side is going to think they are weak. And if they believe they are weak, then they're going to attack them even more. So even though they're not going to solve the problem by counterattacking, they're going to reduce the damage. That's a logic that is always there and often reinforces. We see that in the Palestinian survey that was done recently, in which case, while people want a negotiated settlement, they want compromise, Martin is absolutely right, they want to test nonviolent methods. They simply don't think they can work. And that is why they go back and they say, well, we're going to try this other method. The third reason that is often given, that I think takes hold of in these kind of situations, is that each side comes up with examples to prove that violence pays, to rationalize the tendencies that are propelled by the first causes that I described. The Palestinians will say, well, look, Hezbollah succeeded, when in fact there is no comparison between Hezbollah's situation in Lebanon and the Palestinian situation in the West Bank. And the Israelis will say, look, the U.S. is succeeding in Afghanistan, when there is no comparison at all between the two, and when in fact we also know that we don't know how it's going to turn out to be ultimately in Afghanistan, particularly for those who live next to Afghanistan. So I think it is clear that for those reasons, the propensity is to continue the cycle. Cooperation doesn't evolve on its own, even if they're better off cooperating than hitting each other back and forth. But when you look at the history of the conflict and other conflicts, breakthroughs do happen. Cooperation does emerge, and it has emerged in the Arab-Israeli front in the past. But when you look at the episode where it has emerged not because of a natural learning that takes place, but because of leadership or some extraneous factors that are brought into the table, not because the parties learn. Now, it is true that the process itself opens up opportunities. There are some moments that are more opportune than others. Some people call that ripeness. But the thing is, ripeness itself doesn't lead to a solution. The fact that there are opportunities doesn't mean they're going to be exploited. They are only exploited by leadership. And leadership, by the way, courageous leadership, is somewhat irrational in the short term because you're going against your political instinct, because your political interest. That's what makes it courageous. That's why we call it leadership. That's why Sadat and Rabin lost their lives by their own countrymen doing that. So leadership is hard to come by. You can't count on it. And frankly, I do not build much hope on either Mr. Arafat or Mr. Sharon providing the leadership that is going to be needed to break out of this cycle. And that leaves the United States. And while I think Martin is right, there is an opportune moment for the United States to lead. It is a moment that is partly explained by the exhaustion, partly explained by the fact that majorities in the Arab, among Palestinians and Israelis, still want a negotiated settlement, partly explained by the fact that Arab governments today, by and large, believe that an Arab-Israeli peace agreement is in their interest. That is an opportune moment. And then the American public is fully mobilized behind foreign policy. There is an opportunity for leadership. I am not sure. I can't assume it will be exploited. And frankly, I want to end with one note about the role of the United States in the Arab-Israeli issue. I think the U.S. does not have the option of sitting on the sidelines, not only for moral issues. There are obviously moral reasons why there should be an interest in resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in particular, but also the Arab-Israeli conflict more frankly and more broadly. But the U.S. is involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict. You can't avoid that. I mean, the U.S. is fully committed to the state of Israel, its security and well-being. That is not going to change. And that commitment means that the U.S. is going to be there every time that Israel is going to need the U.S., whether it's through support, military and economic support, but also at the international organizations or the Security Council. Even if the U.S. has to go against the entire international community, it will be there and has been there. On the other side, if Israel has got the upper hand and the Arabs are on the losing end, it's unavoidable that the Arabs are going to blame the U.S. for empowering Israel. And so there is no way you can escape that logic. And for that reason, Arab-Israeli peace has been an axiom of American foreign policy. It is an important American interest in and of itself, because if you don't have that kind of peace, it is very difficult for the United States to navigate through all its interests in the region. And that is why there is no escaping that. And certainly when you have events like a possible war in Iraq, you're going to have a reordering of politics in the region. Power does makes a lot of difference. Priorities are going to shift. People are going to look at the Arab-Israeli different issues differently. Governments are going to try to figure out what their priorities are in the immediate aftermath of that war. But that will only stun the region into a short-term lull before the same reality reappears. There is no escaping the need for an Arab-Israeli peace for America to have an easy time of navigating its interest in the region. Thanks very much.
Well, I was asked to focus on the Gulf dimension of this problem, Middle East peace, can we achieve it? And the first, an obvious point is that in 10 minutes I can't do very much, so I'm going to say a little bit about Iraq, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, but make it very clear that each of these three countries, what happens there, how American policy is played out, has a very direct bearing on what Martin and Shibley have just been saying. Two of these countries, Iraq and Iran, have a vested interest in destroying the peace process, in making things worse, because they believe that a resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict would weaken them. The third country, Saudi Arabia, at least its leadership, has almost the reverse perspective, that an Arab-Israeli peace is perhaps a necessary condition for regime survival. So there is a clear linkage here between what we do in the Gulf and what happens on the Arab-Israeli front. Now, quickly, let me go through these issues, some of which you've already discussed this morning. Iraq. Until yesterday, I must admit, I was pretty pessimistic about the direction of the administration's policy, which seemed to be built around, as John Eikenberry said in a recent Foreign Affairs article, unilateralism, triumphalism, and exceptionalism. As of yesterday, it seems to me there is now a growing sense that one has to be much more precise about what the goals of American policy are in the case of Iraq, and that there is a need for hard evidence of Saddam's activities in the WMD field, legitimacy for any action the international community or the United States takes against him, and allies for whatever comes next. And I believe this weekend, the meeting at Camp David between President Bush and Prime Minister Blair will be a watershed event, in the sense that I believe Blair will essentially tell the President, I put my neck on the line, I support you, but you have to come along with the prevailing view in Europe that this has to be done through New York. You can't go off to Baghdad on your own. And I believe that the evidence will be strong that is ultimately presented at the UN, and that legitimacy will follow, and that after that it will be much easier to get not only the Europeans, but possibly some of the Arab countries on board for punitive action in the event that Saddam does not readmit the inspectors with no constraints. I think this is all fairly well known. It's discussed every day in the papers, so I won't dwell on it. What is less discussed, but what I think is emerging as a huge issue, which has in effect already sobered up the more gung-ho talk about Iraq, and that is the enormity of the task. And by that I do not mean the military task, and I'm not underestimating that at all. I'm talking about the post-war scenario, or what you might call when the cakewalk ends. Because we are talking about occupation if we go to war with a major Arab country. This morning there was a session on post-conflict reconstruction looking at Afghanistan, and just as a bomb nearly went off today in Israel, a huge bomb went off in Kabul, suggesting that post-conflict reconstruction is still very much in the making in Afghanistan. And as we understand now, the components of post-conflict reconstruction first and foremost has to be built around security, then governance, then justice and reconciliation, and then finally, but not necessarily in this order, social and economic well-being. Now, these are four enormous tasks that will have to be faced in Iraq in the event that there's a successful outcome to a war, which I cannot believe there will not be. And each of these issues is going to require great resources, diligence, and staying power. And the more you look into the post-conflict phase of an Iraq operation, the more inevitable it is that you have to work with the international community, you have to have allies, and as I gather, the Deputy Secretary of State said at lunchtime, multilateralism is the way to go. For those, you know, who are interested in history, it is worth going back and looking at examples of where triumphant troops have marched into a city and had flowers garland around their necks, and then chaos has followed very soon after. Even the liberation of Paris, a joyous event in August 1944, when Hemingway liberated the Ritz Bar, among other things. And that was paralleled by the most extraordinary violence in what became known as the Purge, where thousands and thousands and thousands of French were killed quite arbitrarily as scores were settled. And if you don't think that's not going to happen in Baghdad, it will. It will. Any repressive regime such as that builds up such resentment that chaos can quickly follow. So those are the issues we have to, I think, focus on if this conflict is going to continue. Now, Iran, terribly important, because the Iranians right now, one could argue, are almost as dangerous as the Iraqis, particularly in the context of what they are doing on the Arab-Israeli front, namely urging on the Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas to kill Israelis. And that while this clearly reflects huge schisms within Iranian society, the fact of the matter is that this is what we have to deal with. Now, the Bush campaign was very coy about Iran. There were hopes that if Bush won the election, there would be a new look at Iranian policy. The vice president in his previous incarnation, you remember Chairman Cheney, gave a lot of speeches saying that Iran policy needed revision, we needed to open up the oil trade with Iran. He was chairman of Halliburton at the time, and there was hopes that this would happen. And certainly you could say that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the Iranians were more cooperative than perhaps had been anticipated, and certainly were helpful at the Bonn conference in December when the provisional government in Afghanistan was put together. But then everything turned on a dime, and the Iranian complicity in the Karine A incident, the provision of arms to the PLO, completely illegal, clearly dramatically changed the perspective of the Bush administration. The axis of evil and everything that followed is well known. Today we have a standoff with the Iranians. The Iranians themselves are split seminally down the middle between extremists and moderates, and I know those two terms need much more explanation, but I don't have time. The reality is the hardliners in Iran are scared. They're scared of the domestic situation, which could get out of hand. They're scared because the economy is in the dumps. They're scared of encirclement. They believe that if we go to Baghdad, they will be next on the list. They are constantly being attacked for mishandling foreign policy, and that includes Khatami. And I would argue that this is a very dangerous situation, because beyond the issue of Iranian terrorism, the thing we really have to be worried about is the Iranian nuclear weapons program, which is making progress. And I think it would be reasonable to argue that the more isolated and encircled Iran is, much of it of its own making, of course, the more likelihood it is that the bomb program will continue, and that we will then be faced with the same sort of dilemma we face now with Iraq. Iran does have a way out. It can legitimately pull out of the NPT and claim that Iraq is the reason it's doing so, but it can also proceed with a covert program. And if so, it would then be in violation of UN security, of the NPT, and would be subject to sanctions. So this issue of how to handle the Iranian nuclear program is intimately linked to overall relations with Iran and Iran's behavior on the peace process. My own view has always been that if the Iranians changed tack on dealing with Israel, all the other problems would be resolvable, including the nuclear one. Now, finally, Saudi Arabia. This is a huge dilemma for this administration and for this country, of course, because of the large number of participants in 9/11 who were of Saudi origin, and the fact that the Saudis have behaved extraordinarily irresponsibly when it comes to supporting extremists around the world. On the other hand, and this is the dilemma, they have behaved remarkably responsibly when it comes to the management of oil, its production, and in particular, its production in a time of shortage, where they have often made up the shortfall because they are the last country with spare capacity that can do this. The United States is criticized frequently for policy towards Saudi Arabia, particularly incidentally in Europe. A lot of Europeans note with glee the sort of hypocrisy of the administration as it beats up on Arafat and the Iranians and the Iraqis for their undemocratic behavior, but gives a pass to what they call Soviet Arabia. They argue that, you know, in many respects, Saudi Arabia is far less democratic than Iran. And, of course, the Europeans have a very different attitude towards Iran than the Bush administration. Now, the question, therefore, is how to advance reform in Saudi Arabia without making things worse. One scenario that's popular with the neoconservatives is destroy Saddam Hussein, occupy Baghdad, and the Saudis will get the message that if not Tehran, then Riyadh may be next in line for our wrath. The problem with that scenario is there's absolutely no guarantee that what will follow the royal family will be any better as far as the United States is concerned. In fact, it could be a great deal worse. So the second, sort of the counter scenario, would of course be progress on the Arab-Israeli front, which would then give the Crown Prince and those who support reform in Saudi Arabia some hope. It's difficult at this point in time to judge where exactly Saudi Arabia will come down. My guess is that the Bush administration will continue, quite rightly in my judgment, to handle them with kid gloves, if only that the oil factor is still terribly important and Saudi Arabia must be managed carefully. It has to be taken into account that while we all hope any conflict with Iraq would be over quickly, you cannot guarantee that, and given the uncertainty of markets and the continued importance of Saudi Arabia, even though we are filling up the strategic petroleum reserve, even though the Russians want to pump more oil and help us, the reality is there simply is no substitute for Saudi Arabia at this point in time, and that while we may find some substitute in the future, it's not going to happen this year. Thank you.